mixed with mine. So we were able to do that, perform. We were able to perform it like that on The Daily Show last night. So that performance is up on online. And I think it's a really powerful one because of the generations, too. You know, so I'm the older generation, the younger generation. And it really kind of complicates the narrative and adds layers to it. And that's important to me because, like, all narratives are complicated. You know, we tend to like to slim them down, but I like to add to that and to add to the voices that are coming
out. Thank you for listening to the just completed program. If you'd like to offer feedback on any of our programming, please email us at info@wpfw.org.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
A pleasure to be with you this morning on this momentous occasion for our collective and the nation and the world. So we are celebrating Juneteenth. We're honoring Juneteenth today. And so one of the things that is I think really important is this idea of the news of Emancipation Proclamation traveling slowly to the Deep South in Texas. But here at WPFW, we talk about this story really as a story of power traveling slowly and of freedom being seized. Denise, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, everybody talks about General Order Number 3, and I had the occasion to kind of like read it last year, but last night I just kind of sat down and read the whole thing. And it was very interesting that there's some references in the order there that kind of echo what we have been dealing with for centuries. The one in terms of the writing and the way it's written, it states that the people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. Now, we all know that's conditional. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor, i.e., you will still be working and you will be quote-unquote hired at a very reduced rate or in exchange for bartering materials. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts, and this is after they fought valiantly throughout the nation for democracy, and that they will not be supported in idleness.
Idleness.
Yes, we're just so idle.
We have been so idle for several hundred years.
Yes, we've been working in the fields and running around and dealing with Confederacy and doing this, that, and the others, but we've been idle either there or elsewhere. So I found that extremely interesting that this is in the general order. There's some other references in there where there's a lot of conditions for, you know, our ancestors in terms of what they could or could not do. There was also a lot of reference with regard to, how everyone comported themselves after they
I learned of the that they were quote unquote free.
Yes.
You know, they comported themselves in a kind of like, you know, everybody was orderly and nobody was loud and out of control. So we all know that verbiage and we all know that.
Right.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's interesting that that language, particularly the language about idleness, which is, you know, this idea that you are going to continue to force us into labor. And so when we have these conversations, these modern day conversations about, you know, the reality of whether slavery actually ended, these are the things I think that we're talking about, right? We can talk about amendments and what these amendments granted, but we're talking about some very sophisticated language and some sophisticated thinking. There was not the intent to have us be anything other than in servitude as a people to you know, Europeans that came here, stole land, stole people, stole resources. As Chairman O'Malley Yeshitela likes to say, to get their come up,
right?
And, you know, on our backs. And so, I think what we're talking about is then the next phase of it, which was sharecropping. And you know, my grandmother's father was a sharecropper. And so my great-grandfather, my maternal great-grandfather, and so she had stories about that time period for her, and just the how hard her father worked for someone else just to be able to not even so much a life, but to just something that did not even provide for the basic needs. And then him having to carve out his own dignity under those conditions, because I think we sometimes forget that as we're, you know, as a people, as we have gone through this, as we have gone through bondage, as we have gone through death camps,
right,
as we have done all of these things, we've had to figure out our own way to carve out dignity. We've had to figure out, because that's a lot of bile. That's a lot of emotional and mental bile that you have to swallow. So we've had to do that. And so my grandmother, shout out to Mrs. Willie B. Armstrong, my grandmother who is turning 100 years old this year,
in a few months.
Thank you Jesus. In her sharing those stories, so I'm so thankful that you shared that
right.
General order, that excerpt.
And a lot of that is in terms of like even on Juneteenth and the other any time on any day, this thing embodies the type of stories that really really need to be told transgenerationally.
Yes.
And I think a lot of the younger generation, and including my generation, have not been told the stories because they oftentimes don't want to talk about what transpired in the past or, you know, whatever information that needed to be passed down to give that person a different type of perspective.
Yes.
And how they're tethered to the planet and what their purpose could be. Has been left out of a lot of families.
Yes. So, and not to belabor the point, but I think it's an excellent point.
We need to labor the point.
To avoid idleness. To avoid idleness at all costs. But I want to reinforce that point because I think you are so right. There's so much that we have not shared, that we have not passed on, that we have just not gathered folks in a room and said, hey, you know, to our children, to our grandchildren, these stories.
Right.
And I think it is, you know, critical and incumbent upon us, particularly as we watch. And I don't know what the response to this is, but maybe later on today in the show with our fabulous guest, by the way, WPFW family, that we will be able to have some conversation about some of this. But when we are looking at and thinking about the various things that they are doing within the public school system, how they are, their everything is revisionist, how our history, the erasure, the cultural and historic erasure. We're going to have not only a collective response to that, but part of it is our responsibility in terms of, we know the truth, right? We know it. And we have to be the owners of those stories. And as the owners of those stories, we have to gift them to our generations. And that just has to become common practice.
Right. So when we talk about education, which is extremely important, we are going to have revisionist history. It's been like that for decades, centuries. This is what's done on a national, international level. For a lot of the indigenous people, African-Americans. I mean, there's a revisionist history that's being marketed globally. As you know, I'm the co-editor of the Osiris Papers, which is a sequel to the ISIS Papers. Raymond Wimbush and I had the book published by Black Classic Press. Shout out to Paul Coates.
Nice.
Which is a sequel to Francis Cress Welsing's The ISIS Papers. And it talks about the global system, and it talks about, you know, how these things are done on an international level, and to keep us from, you know, ignorant to what the past was.
Okay. Well, as we said, or maybe I didn't say at the top of the show, that we have such a dynamic show. And I know my audience is sick of me saying that, because I say it every week, that we are going to have an epic show. Brace yourselves. And I mean it every
week. And it's
week.
Always dynamic.
It is. And so we, one of the things that we're going to be doing this morning is going into the field. And we have so many wonderful, beautiful honorings and celebratory events and commemorative events that are happening across the DMV. And so we want to check in with some folks. And so the first person that we're going to be, that we have the honor of checking in with this morning is Frank Smith, who is the director, founder of the African American Civil War Memorial Museum. Good morning, Mr. Smith.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. And I have to say, I'm just so tickled that you are on the line. I think I'm fanning.
I hate to disappoint you, but I'm standing in for Frank. He is over at the museum office.
Taking care of business.
African-American Civil War Plaza. This is Thomas.
Oh, this is Thomas. Oh, okay. But you know what? Proximity. Proximity counts, brother. Proximity counts.
We're working to support each other today and make things come off hopefully better than right now arranging this call.
That's okay. That is quite all right.
So tell us what's happening.
Well, first of all, I want to say right up front, we appreciate everybody being here between 11 and 12 o'clock to read the names of the soldiers who actually landed in Galveston. That is the most important part of our program.
Okay.
To honor those. As it often says, if someone calls your name, you don't die, you live forever.
Ooh,
we want to remember those brothers and sisters
that
landed. I think people have heard the story already, that they were sent away from D.C. from participating in the Grand Review, you know, to not get their props for tracing down Robert E. Lee, and it led to the end of the Civil War. But the thing that they did do, because of the storm, they landed in Galveston. And when they got there, they were surprised to find out that the enslaved people had not been released.
Mm.
So they went back to their commander and demanded that General Order Number 3 be written and posted in the churches.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how people in Galveston found out. But rest assured, troops had been in Texas since 62, you know, and they had defeated the Confederate forces. And the governor of Texas actually advocated power. That's how Granger had the power to be able to read, you know, his proclamation, his famous General Order Number 3. He did it because basically we had won the war before then. So we have the names of those soldiers. We want people to come out and help us read the names of those soldiers and honor them properly.
So, that just touches my heart, my spirit, my soul, especially your adage that when we speak our ancestors' names, that, you know, we assure that they are always here, that they have not perished. But I want to ask you one question, Thomas, and that is, what does Juneteenth mean for you? Because you're a native Texan.
Yeah, he's from Texas.
Yeah.
Born and raised. Well, that's the controversy. And I think the earlier shows have been doing a great job of explaining more of the history.
Yes.
I'm from a part of Texas that's about 150 miles from Galveston. You know, so you think we were sitting around waiting, you know, on people to free us? I don't think so.
Right.
I don't think so. You know, we are a family. I had to come at it from my personal point of view. You know, we're a family again that were 150 miles away. And I have the deeds to the land that my great-grandparents acquired by 1925.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
wow.
They worked hard and they were very productive farmers. The story of Juneteenth, the first thing that African Americans did was find their families.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't celebrate. The first thing they did when they had the power to leave, you know, when Granger and the troops, you know, enforced the Emancipation Proclamation, that don't mean that they protected all the people in Texas. Mm-hmm. You know, there was still slavery. You know, there was still a lot of killing and a lot of fighting.
Yeah.
You know, so people had to survive that. I later married into a family that was based in that area, you know, Dickinson, Galveston, you know, those towns around Galveston. They had to fight to maintain their living. You know, it was not a peaceful transition.
Right.
You know? So Juneteenth meant an opportunity, once in power, to go out and find your families and begin to live for freedom, to have some income. People who had been working the land, that was the most important thing, and it is today. The most important thing was actually acquire rights to land. And a lot of them did it. A lot of them were able to get scrape together money through their families and begin to farm, particularly cotton farming, potato farming, and sugar cane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, it's not my duty today, but when you talk about the economy of the South, it was not just based on cotton. Cotton was essential.
Right.
But sugar cane was almost equally a value. Mm-hmm. And that is some hard work.
Yes.
That is some hard work that people had to do. You know, so when these families got together and began to develop, you know, for themselves, they showed their independence. And that's how you got some of the black towns. I know later today you're going to have Mayor Johnny Ford talking about, you know, the rise of black towns.
Yes.
And the relationships that they have. So again, people, you know, in Texas we had over 9 black colleges. You know, they developed over the years, you know. So people went about the business of liberation, went about the business of gaining freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And they were determined about that. You know, so Juneteenth was a launching pad, you know, an opportunity, but it's something that we earn and we work for.
Ooh, you said a whole word, something that we lived and worked for. Do you think that is, I guess, two things. One, this idea that we have earned it. Do you believe that is a sentiment that we as a collective have today? Because, you know, it seems to me that to some degree we are still holding on to this narrative that somehow the reason that we are still facing certain conditions is because we haven't worked hard enough or we haven't earned our place. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. We don't have all day to talk to Thomas Platt.
Right, that's right. I'm like, I'm chomping at the bit at this point.
Yeah,
because it's like, that's like a 24-hour conversation.
That is a 24-hour conversation in the minute and 30-second form.
Again, I don't come at our struggle through scholarly means.
Yeah.
You know, I appreciate the scholars very, very, very much. You know, but I work, and I was taught to work through my family.
Yes.
You know, I knew my great-grandparents. You know, they weren't in the book. I went to their house. You know, I saw their clean yards from an acre away from the entry point.
Yes.
Why was it clean like that? Because they wanted to protect themselves from anybody intruding upon their property. You know, my great-grandmother won the state fair award for the best sweet potato, you know, growing that year.
She
worked. She was uneducated. She could not read or write, but she was the general of the property, the 400 acres that she and her husband acquired. When they worked to pick cotton, they hired their other family members. They paid them. They not only paid them salaries, they paid their poll tax.
Mm-hmm.
You work here, you work for the property, and you work for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You go vote. they paid their poll tax.
Yeah, the poll tax was another aspect of the whole voting issue, disempowerment.
And so, you know, you guys know me, and I know the radio audience doesn't, you know, but that's the kind of pride that's in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And y'all know me, that when I talk about it, I can't keep a straight face.
Yeah.
Because I'm proud of that.
Right.
You know, I'm proud of growing up in family. A lot of people in my generation, we're like third, fourth generation out, and we're six generations total. You know, they say, well, I'm a first generation college student. That's not true in my family. You know, my grandparents went to college. You know, my father and mother were teachers. They went to college, obviously. You know, They passed it on to their children. All five of my brothers and sisters and I, we all graduated from college. Mm-hmm. You know, my three kids have graduated from college. You know, and that's not to brag. That's to say we worked.
Right.
You know, we earned it.
Right.
You know, and we teach our grandkids. And now we're into that third generation below me, you know, where we're teaching them. You work. You go to summer schools. You go to museums. You go read books. You do things in the library. And you contribute to your community. You know, you make a difference in your life. You know, so we pass that down as a heritage, as a legacy. You know, and we just do that.
Well, yeah, we just had that whole intro about how important that is. And here you are living and breathing and demonstrating not only that it is done, and what the results, what the outcomes are of doing that kind of intergenerational work. So, well, Brother Thomas.
Yes, Tommy.
We thank you.
I want to apologize for Frank for stealing his time, but I enjoyed talking to you guys.
Right,
you
no know, problem. Are you going to be, in terms of the reading of the names, will he be there later on today, later on this morning?
Okay. We'll get it together on the tech side, you know, to make these connections straight.
Okay, great.
All right. Thank you all.
Thank you, Thomas. Wow.
Yeah. You know what's really important, I think, in terms of looking at, in terms of when you use the term earn, or you use the term we're entitled. It's like, that's like a misnomer to me,
mm-hmm.
because there's no earning here.
Yeah.
And when we talk about quote unquote education,
mm-hmm.
we
mm-hmm.
are talking, you know, I think about it and I'm like, people weren't educated before they came over here.
Right.
Yeah, we were way educated before we came, because we are some of the original people on the planet.
Yes.
So we had the original, you know, health systems. We had the original, you know, way of communicating. We had so much stuff. I mean, Tony Browder's not here to kind of like.
Currency.
Right. We had the whole setup.
Yes.
So just because you're not acquainted with the quote unquote broken English or the way that they set up their educational system does not mean you're not educated.
Right,
okay.
Right.
So when Thomas talks about his grandmother and grandfather and all the other grandmothers, grandfathers that reflect what exactly he was talking about in terms of land ownership, they were extremely bright people. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a knowledge of agrarian sciences that probably rivals today.
Yes.
And so, you know, when we look at it from that perspective, it's not about quote unquote being educated. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because I find that the educational system does not lend itself to being educated.
Right. It's stripping us in so many ways.
Right. Right. And it helps to shape and to minimize your culture, yes, and it's a way of assimilating and acculturating into quote unquote the mainstream culture, the Eurocentric culture.
The Eurocentric culture,
mm-hmm.
which when we look at it from a hierarchical lens, means that we're inculcated into the bottom for their servitude.
Right. Yeah, I am not your Negro.
Right.
Yes. Which is fabulous, by the way.
Okay.
I mean, anyway.
So we are going to continue WPFW fam with checking in with folks across the DMV. So we have another wonderful guest on today, and his name is Mr. Amar Khan. Brother Khan.
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for asking me to join.
Hello, Mr. Khan.
Thank you for having us. So jump in. Tell us, what are you involved in this Juneteenth day?
Yeah. You see, the thing is, now I come from South Asia, okay? I have lived many years in South Asia, and I am from Pakistan, which I think the British unnecessarily divided India. We should have been one country in the first place.
Absolutely.
But when they ruled over us, we were one. Before they came, we were one. I mean, the religious, some people have one religion, another had another religion. There are so many different cultures in India, but that didn't mean that we could not live together. But then they left and they divided us. And I come from a group in Pakistan, which is called the Baluch. We are an ethnic minority in Pakistan. So we are treated in the by the Pakistani power elite, in the powers that be, or if you may call the deep state, in the very same way that the African-American people in America are treated by the deep state of the United States. And that is why you see they have been left behind in so many different spheres of life. My people, which we call Baluch, we have also been left behind in Pakistan in a similar way. You know, when the deep state, when the main players in the state structure don't appreciate you, then you suffer. I know it at a very personal level. So, and that is why I say that my people, Baluch and the Black, are united by way of the oppression of the dominant group. It doesn't matter whether it is America or whether it is Pakistan or any other country. When the dominant group is one, and when you are in not in the dominant group, then you pay a heavy price. Yeah. And that I see all across the United States. I am very surprised that, you see, I feel very bad, actually, because I did not know about the Black history in America. To be very honest, I came to America because I was a gay person. And for a gay person, Pakistan is not very welcoming. It's a very difficult place. Okay. And that is the reason I left Pakistan to come here. And honestly, had I known about Black history of America, I might not have come here. I might have gone to some other country maybe. Because this Black history, that is not only Black history, we see that that history's legacy is still being reenacted by the very same forces who think that one human is superior to another. Mm-hmm. How can that be? How can one human be superior to another? It is simply, you see, it defies my human comprehension.
Okay, so
but there are some who still believe that what you saw in Charlottesville in 2017, August, when they all came together, when you saw that backlash over the victory of the first ever Black president in this country, some people have still, you see, are groaning over that, and it is, I don't think, a very nice place to be.
So in other words, before understanding the history, before understanding our collective's history, you did not really have a full understanding that when we are talking about colonialism, that the United States has a patent on the blueprint for colonialism and imperialism and racism and terrorism against groups of people.
Yeah, you see, the thing is, I was a progressive, okay, all my life. Mm-hmm. Since I'm 64 years now, since 19, when I was 19, I've been a progressive. And one thing I really hated myself for was that I did not know much about Black history in America, mm-hmm. other than Martin Luther King, doctor. He had sacrificed his life for the equality of races. Right. This is honestly... this or a few other things that we knew about the Blacks in America. We did not know how much the tyranny is still there.
Right.
Well, how much the thinking of the ruling classes that is holding the people back is still there.
Yes.
This is when I came to America, In 2005, I got a chance to go to Vanderbilt University. I was a journalist in Pakistan.
Okay.
But when I came to America, I was doing odd jobs because my journalism experience in Pakistan and also in the United Arab Emirates, that did not, you see, matter here. So I was doing odd jobs. And finally, I got a chance to go to Vanderbilt University for a fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where my eyes opened. I had a very... You see, we had very good journalism professors. Right. They were black professors. They told us about the real story of the black folks in America.
Right.
And that is why I got really interested.
Okay. So we're going to take a station break, Mr. Khan. And so when we come back from the break, I'm going to ask you to share with us the Juneteenth activities that you are involved in. Okay, so you are listening.
What time? Because I'm on my way through.
Right, just as soon as we come back from the station break. So you're listening to What's at Stake on WPFW, and we'll be right back.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Very often, Juneteenth is presented as a story of news of the Emancipation Proclamation traveling slowly to the Deep South in Texas. But it was really a story of power traveling slowly and of freedom being seized. On Wednesday, June 19th, WPFW presents Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance from 5 a.m. until midnight. Through discussions, music, and spoken word, we will interrogate the history of that day, the true meaning of freedom, and the role resistance continues to play in securing liberation. That's Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance, Wednesday, June 19th, 5 a.m. until midnight, on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
His activities, but I would love for you to share with our WPFW family the Juneteenth activities that you are part of this day.
Yeah, today I'm actually doing, I've organized some events at the Bus Boys and Poets in Anacostia. I'm grateful that Reverend Willie Wilson will be speaking at 11 a.m. Reverend Willie Wilson needs no introduction. He's
none whatsoever.
Everyone knows him in D.C. He's an icon. And then Professor John Britton, who will tomorrow be getting the Thurgood Marshall Award. He's a lawyer and professor. He has taught many, you see, students civil rights, and he will be speaking 11 a.m. At 1 p.m., there is another event, which is same place, Anacostia Bus Boys and Poets. And that is White Supremacy Today. And that panel I will be moderating. And that includes some very, very, well, quite a bit scholar people in that forum. And one of them is Mr. Aaron Jenkins, Daryl Aaron Jenkins. He has been confronting white supremacy for many years now. He is the executive director of One People's Project in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. So he'll be coming all the way from Philadelphia for that event. And then we have got Reverend Driscoll, Quadricos Driscoll. He's a professor at George Washington University, and he will be speaking also there. And we have another eminent lawyer, M.O. He will be speaking, and then that is Professor Yannick Rice Lamb. She is with the Harvard University professor. She will be speaking. All these speakers will be talking about white supremacy today. And I hope I have not missed out any name here. And then there is one on the Secure DC Law, which is more of a stick for the black youth in DC.
Yes.
Than anything else.
Yes, absolutely.
So that will be moderated by Keymon Freeman, Jackson. He is the moderator. And in that, the speakers are Nini Taylor and then Samantha Page Davis and Dr. Rhonda Hamilton. They will be speaking. And the last final thing is a very important issue that is very dear to my heart. It is on reparations and restorative justice, in which Mr. George Jones, who's the CEO of Bread for the City, and he's also with the reparations informal group in Washington, D.C. He and Corey Shaw, who is with Empower D.C., they will be there. And people from the affected community. You see, we know about Berry Farm in D.C., but there are other affected Black historic communities, and not many people know about them. And one is in Brown Grove, Hanford County in Alexandria, in Virginia, and she will be coming from there. Her name is Ms. Diane Drake Smith. She's an affected member of the community. Over there, there is a historic Black land, and Wegmans is trying to take over from those people over there. Wow. The group, the big giant grocery shop called Wegmans. So they have that struggle going on there. And then in Gum Springs, Alexandria, Virginia, those people were, you see, one of the first, they were, as you can understand, they were surrounded by all kind of very challenging environments. But still they managed to build their community and thrived and survived.
Right.
So it was great, you see, their resilience, that they could do all that in spite of the situation that existed there, the time, the segregation, the lynching every day. But they still strived and survived. So that is the community called Gum Springs. And today the developers are knocking at their doors to get over, buy their property, and that historic community, Black faces that kind of a challenge over there.
I tell you, Mr. Khan, Brother Khan, yeah. your first of all, your list of events and activities
is exhaustive.
I mean, it's amazing. And so kudos to you and all of the people who are part of organizing, the different communities to have these fabulous succession or series of events. And I want to tell our WPFW, because family, hey, listen, go to Busboys and Poets website, because I'm absolutely certain that you will be able to find a list of these activities. Brother Khan, thank you so much for sharing, for coming, for organizing, for committing to stay, and understanding that yes, this country absolutely is one that is abusive of groups, particularly Black people and other groups of color. But we have to have warriors. We have to have warriors. So thank you for committing to that, and also for giving us the perfect segue to our next guest, which is Marsha Adebayo Coleman. Good morning, Marsha.
Hello, Marsha.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Khan.
Thank you.
Good morning. How are you?
We're well. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
He gave you a perfect segue.
I agree with you. It could not have been more perfect. Let me also invite, because it's wonderful that we're having so many discussions about liberation. And even though the media, the corporate media is portraying, even the White House, portraying Juneteenth as a time for people just to barbecue and party.
Yes.
Our community is having very serious discussions about how do we liberate ourselves? How do we build upon, for example, the U.S. colored troops, who were always portrayed as, these sort of, subsidiaries, attachments to the white troops in the Civil War. And what we find out, of course, as we get more into understanding these troops is that they were actually African liberators and saw themselves as African warriors mm-hmm. who were going to liberate their family and their community during the Civil War. I mean, in fact, their motto was give us a gun and we will free ourselves.
Right.
And of course, we're taught in school that it was, you know, the abolitionists, or it was Abraham Lincoln, or it was all these other white people who were liberating us. And of course, we take this time out now during Juneteenth to understand that we liberated ourselves, yeah. as Harriet Tubman said.
Now, Adebayo, for the listening audience, even though, you know, you're very well known in the DMV area, but could you please give the listening audience a kind of like a general presentation of like who you are and what exactly you're working on right now, which is extremely important.
Yeah, thank you for that. Who am I? That's always a big question. But, you know, I see myself
as someone
fighting for the, for the liberation of Black people.
Yes.
And you know, I'm a whistleblower. I led the movement to get the first civil rights and whistleblower law passed in the United States called No Fear, mm-hmm. Notification of Federal Employees Anti-Discrimination Retaliation Act of mm-hmm. 2002.
Yes.
Every federal employee must take No Fear training throughout the entire government now. There are certain provisions within the federal government that protect whistleblowers and Black people because of this law. And right now, I'm very deeply involved in a movement to stop the desecration of one of the oldest and most significant African burial grounds in the world. It's what we call the South-South Cemetery, where our ancestors who came over from, you know, from Africa, from the great kingdoms of Ghana and Songhai and Kartem-Bornu, and were forced into this barbarism that Europeans like to call slavery. I'm not, you know, we'd love to have a conversation about language one day while we're still calling ourselves the same names that our oppressors call us.
Yes.
But you know, they are buried there in downtown Bethesda, Maryland, of all places, right next to their descendants who survived the barbarism, what we call European barbarism. And they're all there in Bethesda, Maryland. And Bethesda, Maryland has made an intentional decision to erase every trace of their existence. And so if you go to, for example, 5204 River Road right now, you will see the dump trucks out there. You will see the cement trucks out there. You will smell what desecration smells like. You will see them digging up your ancestors. You will see them pouring the concrete on top of their bodies. That is what we saw yesterday when we had our first, when we had our second Juneteenth event called the Ma'afa, the genocide. And people were actually able to go there and actually see an actual desecration occurring. If you come today, you will still see the desecration occurring. And so we're asking everyone to come out at 3:00 today. Join us at 5204 River Road. You will still see the trucks out there. You'll still see them pouring concrete on top of African bodies. And if you ask me, like, who is responsible for all of this, I think we've got to point the finger not only at the developer, who is clearly responsible for this, but also government officials
yes.
who have given them the permit to carry out yes. this atrocity, mm-hmm. such as Mark Elrich, who is the county executive of Montgomery County, and the darling of all the liberals, Congressman Jamie Raskin, mm-hmm. who for the last 3 or 4 months has refused to meet with us to talk about this atrocity occurring in his district. So we're not asking him to act as a national leader like he does on MSNBC 3 or 4 times a day, but to act as our representative that the people in our district voted for Jamie Raskin, and he refuses to meet with members of his constituency to talk about an atrocity occurring in his district. So one of the things I would ask all of our WPFW listeners to do is to write to Congressman Jamie Raskin and tell him to stop the desecration in Moses African Cemetery. Yes. He needs to go to the floor of the Congress. He needs to pronounce this as an atrocity against Black people, and that this must stop. But he hasn't opened his mouth except a very shameful press release that he sent out saying that, you know, desecration is not a good thing. Well, desecration is intended to erase people. And what you're going to see on River Road, which used to be a thriving Black community, is total erasure. You would never know that Black people owned all the land in this area of River Road, that this land is now worth billions. You talk about intergenerational wealth.
Yes.
There's a man in our community named Mr. Harvey Matthews. His family owned the land where Whole Foods is now situated. The KKK used to march up and down River Road in Bethesda 3 or 4 times a week. They had Black people posted to let the community, to give a signal to the community that the KKK, which, and as Brother Harvey says, they were police in the day and KKK at night, mm-hmm. that they were about to march up and down River Road, and Black people had to have blackouts, so that you turned off all the lights in your house and you prayed to survive the latest KKK attack. And on 2 occasions in Brother Harvey's family, they pulled out his father and nearly beat him to death in front of the family, and they pulled out his grandfather and nearly beat him to death in front of the family. And they beat Brother Harvey when he was a child. Mm. You won't read that in any Montgomery County textbooks, but that's what was happening on River Road. And so this Juneteenth is really important for our community. And we ask people, because the only way you're going to learn about your history is through us. And so we're asking, through the Black community and stations like WPFW. So we're asking people to please come out and support us. We are on the front line of the Black cemetery struggle. Right. We are face to face, nose to nose with the developer and with these politicians that we keep electing and putting into power, who are creating such an incredible violent atmosphere and environment
right
in our community.
Adebayo, you have really been just a example of the kind of fearlessness and, you know, just continuing to go despite all the obstacles that have been thrown in front of us. You continue to, you know, exhibit the type of courageous notions to, you know, to just to continue to go. And as I told you before, I know the ancestors are with you and behind you, as well as the rest of the group, as well as all of us who, you know, across the country who have been fighting for a respect of the sacred lands of our ancestors. You know, we have the Moses Cemetery, and as we well know, I talked to you about it before in terms of Mount Zion Cemetery over there in Georgetown, and there's places in New York, Virginia, you know, so a lot of people have been under siege and still looking for their ancestors and where they have been buried. I wanted to just say one small thing about the Microsoft people who are going to be building in Virginia. That I read that article and I just literally started crying because it was just a deliberate lost the paperwork, throw them, you know, dig up the land, put them somewhere, people looking for their people. I mean, it was just the dismissive nature. The nature of the dismissive nature was in and of itself I can't even describe. But I can just only feel and see how these things have happened over and over and over again. And let me say this one last thing. All the people, all of our ancestors, the folks down south who owned all that land, who possibly had family, you know, family plots on that land, their stuff was lost too.
Yes.
Not only their land was taken, but those plots were taken. Their vitality was taken.
That's the intergenerational wealth.
Yes.
And that's what, you know, that this is structural white supremacy. This isn't just picking off a community in Bethesda, picking off one in Virginia. There is a concerted plan to separate Black people from land.
Yes.
I mean, these are land struggles. These are land. These are intergenerational struggles.
Yes.
If you don't mind, can I just tell you who's going to be at our program today very quickly?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Marcia.
So we'll have Steve Lieberman, who will be talking about our case before the Maryland Supreme Court. We are expecting a decision any day now from the Maryland Supreme Court, and we'll see if they're going to go towards Dred Scott, which is that Black people have no rights that whites are bound to respect, and developers now have a right to just come in and take our land, or whether or not they're going to turn the corner. So he's going to be talking about that today. Jack Rasmussen, director of the American University Katzen Center. A lot of people in WPFW became aware of the Moses struggle through the exhibits. We've had two exhibits at the American University, and we're about to create a third exhibit, hopefully, with Jack's permission, at the American University. Baba Mosey, president of UNIA, Universal Negro Improvement Association, and Evergreen Productions will be performing today. Robert Stubberfield, a very important activist in the DMV, will be the MC. We will have Andy Shalal, who is, as you know, the founder of Busboys and Poets. Andy. He will be there. We'll have songs by Dr. Karen Wilson, Ama Eche Fu. We have called, Ben and Jerry's will be there to hand out free ice cream because it's hot. And so they were there yesterday. They will be there again today. We have a fabulous African chef named Mama Toni Oni, and she will be preparing African food. So we're asking everyone to come out. And just one last thing. We found out that one of the people, and all the people at Moses are so precious, but because this is Juneteenth, we are particularly focusing on Private William H.H. Brown, who is also, he was dismembered. His body was scattered throughout the entire cemetery. These are hate crimes. But Brother Brown, Private Brown, a young Black man who volunteered to be a liberator of our people during war, fought in two of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War, and only to come home to Montgomery County. And when he passed away, Montgomery County, you know, decided to do what they did with a lot of Black people. They dismembered their bodies. They scattered them throughout Moses African Cemetery. So we are demanding that Montgomery County, and, you know, this is something that Congressman Jamie Raskin and, oh, Lord, you know, County Executive Mark Elrich, who I think we have no words at this point to describe how disappointed we are in him. We're asking them to retrieve his remains and to return like any other military veteran. He needs to be respected. And so yesterday we had, you know, U.S. Reenactor, U.S. colored troops marching down River Road with their muskets to Moses Cemetery. And they played taps for Brother, for our Private Brown. And we laid a wreath for him because even though his body is underneath the concrete now, we respect our brother and we are going to show respect to him. And so we're asking the community to come out between 3 and 6 Moses Cemetery, which is 5204 River Road. It's going to be a fabulous, fabulous program again. And not only to celebrate, but to learn how you can fight this kind of white oppression and erasure of our history and our land.
Marcia, first of all, thank you so much. And, you know, I know you and know you well, and it's always so humbling to hear you discuss what is happening with Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition, how the work of the coalition really reflects not just the issue of Moses Cemetery, but really amplifies this issue of racism, which is really, as you talked about, it is disconnecting Black people, people around, of color from around the world, it has always been about disconnecting us from land. And so I think the more that we embrace that idea, the more that we really understand what's at stake here and why we have to continue to press forward. So thank you very much, Marcia, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate all of you. Thank you. Okay. God bless.
And we appreciate your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wow. You know, this thing with this sort of white settler project where you go in somewhere that was not yours and you just strip people of land. I don't know that we say that loudly and boldly enough, that is what is behind, right, the oppression, behind the abusive nature, behind the terrorism, and as Marcia refers to as the barbarism.
Right. Yeah. So the thing is, in terms of when you want to oppress people or take them over you, it's a multi-level endeavor. You attack their culture, mm-hmm. you attack their spirit, you attack their families. It's a multi-level type of approach to really breaking a person down, a group of people, being able to put that person to have a sense of hopelessness about what they can do, you know, not having a sense of control.
Yeah.
So all this stuff is designed in such a way to do those things. And like, again, when we talk about the systemic nature of white supremacy, or, you know, the Eurocentric framework, the Western culture, you know, it's embedded. That's what the components of that culture is. So it's like being able to take over on an international level, all these different groups, like the guy was talking about in Pakistan, you got the ruling class, you got this, that, and the other. It's the same everywhere. So, but for here, for us at home, I think it's extremely important for us to preserve those sacred places of our ancestors, because that's what we're connected to. And that's all we have left from not even being in our homeland.
Right.
So.
And so this is why this show today, this WPFW, is actually WPFW since 5 this morning until midnight. Will be doing its special presentation, Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance, to really discuss the meaning behind Juneteenth, the meaning behind what it means for true liberation and the role of resistance. And so we thank you, WPFW, for our family, our WPFW listeners rather, and family, for supporting WPFW in this way. So before we're approaching the top of the hour, and so we're going to have to take just a quick moment when we get to the top of the hour, but I do want to take these next couple of minutes to introduce our next guest. I might end up having to interrupt her, but I want to take time to introduce our next guest. And so we are fortunate enough, so blessed to have Director Akili, and I hope I'm not mispronouncing her name, Anna E., who is with the African People's Socialist Party. And you know, this young woman is such a dynamic activist, organizer, communicator, historian, and I know personally that I probably have at least 20 years on her. But when I say that, and I say this with all humility and respect, I look at what she has accomplished and the role that she is playing, you know, with the African People's Socialist Party and in St. Petersburg. And it's one of those things where I'm like, I want to be like her when I grow up, you know?
Yeah.
It just warms our collective spirit when you know that we have young people out here, because, you know, doing this work, because this is how the work has always been done,
yes.
right? It's yes. always been done because young people have said, we're not taking this anymore, or because young people recognize that there is a problem that needs addressing and needs addressing in an immediate and urgent manner, and with courage, not without fear, because this is, I mean, we're talking about terrorism, right?
Yes, yes.
But to be able to understand that, no, we have, this is a must. It's not, you know, negotiable. So with that, I am going to introduce her, director Akili Anae, and just as I am about to bring her on, I do want to